Welcome to the Domestic Violence Coronavirus Press Call. My name is Daryl, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Jacques Pettit. Jacques, you may begin.
Thank you, Daryl. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this afternoon to discuss this critical issue during this time of national uncertainty. To begin today's call, we're going to start with Peter Ambler. He's the executive director at Giffords. And so, Peter, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I'm Peter Ambler, executive director at Giffords. Thanks, everybody, for joining the call today. We're thrilled to be joined by Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, who, as I think everybody knows, has been one of the nation's primary champions on the issue of domestic violence and, of course, on the specific nexus between domestic violence and gun violence. We at Giffords, since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States, have been working very diligently to inform the public and the debate writ large about the nexuses between the outbreak of coronavirus and the problem of gun violence. We have a landing page on our website that explores everything from, guns and suicide to, of course, the topic here today, guns and domestic violence. Obviously, gun violence is oftentimes a public concern, but when it comes to guns and domestic violence, we have in this country an epidemic of private violence. And at a time when so many American families are shut in their homes, they're not going outside, they're observing social distancing, there are unique threats that American families face from domestic violence. And as we know, those threats are exacerbated by firearms access that abusers and other dangerous people might have. This is a particularly poignant week to be discussing this topic. It was a year ago, this coming Saturday, that the House of Representatives passed the VAWA reauthorization, which, of course, contains provisions that would help keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. Now, those are provisions that Senator Klobuchar is intimately acquainted with. We have a long history with the senator in the aftermath of the filibuster of the Manchin-Toomey background checks bill in 2013. The first thing that Gabby Giffords did was in 2014 sit down with Senator Klobuchar and agree to start working on this dangerous nexus between gun violence and domestic violence. And over the years in the United States Senate and on the presidential campaign trail, Senator Klobuchar has been a unique, smart, authentic voice on this issue, informing the public and pushing legislation. So we have a lot to talk about. We have experts on the line to go through these threats and concerns in great detail. But right now, I am pleased to turn it over to Senator Klobuchar and hear what she has to say. Senator, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, and thank you to Gabby, and convey my thanks to her and to everyone on the call today. Right now, I think we all know that we are facing an unprecedented public health crisis. Understandably, our focus is and should be, number one, on the patients in the hospitals, the people that need the ventilators, the masks, and protective gear for our healthcare workers. But we know not far behind is going to be another public health issue. And that is, as time goes on and more people are in their homes, as we've asked them to do for good reason, and in their apartments, that we're going to see, and we'll hear from our experts today, issues with domestic violence on the rise. So many times, as you know, think about what we say to victims when they call, when they ask for help, when they call the hotline. We say, leave the house, leave the house. And the opposite message for good public health reasons is being conveyed right now. And isolation, economic uncertainty, general anxiety about the spread of the virus add layers of stress for so many families. And we know as that kind of things happen, the risk of domestic violence also increases. Across the country, calls to domestic violence support centers are increasing and beds at shelters are filling up. And there are too many people right now who are feeling unsafe and find it hard to access the support and services they need. Now, some of this support may be able to be given in a different way, over the phone, confidentially, and that will be good. But some of it may still mean having increased access to shelters and the like. There are people who are afraid of going to the hospital and exposing themselves to the coronavirus, even if they're going to the hospital because they've been beaten up, but there may not be the help for them there. We know that. And then maybe they would normally go to a friend or family member, but they're afraid to go there because they don't want to expose them to the virus if they think they have it. And that's why we are joining forces today with the Gifford Law Center and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence to say that they're not alone. As was mentioned, we have been calling attention to this issue in a big way, as Peter mentioned. I was proud to lead a bipartisan letter with Senator Lisa Murkowski and Bob Casey and 21 of our colleagues to the Administration for Children and Families and the Justice Department's Office on Violence Against Women to make sure that services and resources for victims and survivors of domestic violence remain accessible during this tough time. In the relief package, we provided an additional $2 million for the domestic violence hotline and $45 million for programs that provide shelter and other services. It's a first step. Senator Murkowski and I were in contact this week, just a few days ago actually, talking about what we should do going forward. The other thing, in addition to the funding that I wanted to mention, was what Kevin brought up, and that we know that we need to pass the Violence Against Women Act and get it reauthorized. We upgrade that bill every year, and one of the things that is in that bill this year that is so important, as Peter knows, is the fact that we have this very special provision on domestic violence and stalking, and if people have convictions that they shouldn't be able to go out and get a gun. Debbie Dingell led this provision in the House. It is in the bill to pass the House that is sitting on Senator McConnell's desk right now. And I know what the stakes are. In my former job, I've thought time and time again how when you have victims of domestic violence, it's not always just one victim. It's an entire family, their kids, their extended family, and it's an entire community. So we're going to keep working on this, and I was very glad that Senator Murkowski is helping out with funding and the like, and I'm also so pleased to partner with the Giffords Law Center and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence on this very important matter. So I want to thank Rachel for being on the call, as well as Peter for his work, and Julia as well for her work. And so let's hear it from some of the experts, and then we can take your questions.
Thank you so much, Senator. I'm going to introduce our implementation director, Julia Weber, right now. Julia has a unique and extensive background. She's been working with courts and legislatures drafting domestic violence policies for over 25 years. She has and does continue to teach domestic violence law, which she's been training on since 1994. She writes extensively about the domestic violence courts and risks to children exposed to domestic violence. And she serves frequently as an expert witness in domestic violence family law cases. So I will stop there. Julia is the author of the memo that has been circulated to you that discusses the nexus between gun violence and domestic violence during a time of pandemic. And I'm proud to introduce her to you now. Julia?
Well, thank you, Peter. And thank you very much, Senator, for leading the way on this and for your leadership over this many years on the issue. Obviously, this is a difficult time for everyone, but we know for those who are living with a violent partner or family member, the isolation and limitations associated with the pandemic create an even more dangerous situation. We're also hearing stories about increases in calls across the country to domestic violence service providers, to police. There are difficulties finding shelter beds in some places, panic buying, stockpiling of firearms and ammunition, and significant increases in background checks being conducted. Reportedly, there's been a 36% increase in February alone, and we'll anticipate higher numbers in March. A substantial portion of these sales appear to be first-time gun buyers, with children and families confined to their homes. Bringing new guns into the household across the nation introduces proven risks. So those perpetrating domestic violence, we know, exert control over their victims' behaviors. They interfere with their ability to interact with others, prevent victims from accessing resources. They create financial and emotional instability. They may be using the virus itself to exert control over their victims. And when abusive partners or former partners also have access to firearms, the risk of harm to family members and others is significantly greater. Female victims are 5 times more likely to be killed if the man abusing them has firearms. And we know millions of women alive today have been shot or shot at by violent partners. Children witness and experience this violence at home and in their communities, and we know those living with a combination of violence and guns are at increased risk. During this pandemic, many young people don't have access to teachers, counselors, coaches, and mentors who might otherwise provide support and protection. Staying at home right now can decrease the risk of COVID-19 exposure for sure, but with firearms in homes, too many people are at increased risk of experiencing other negative health consequences because they are isolated in homes with people who are abusing them. And we can decrease the risk of death and injury by removing firearms from those who have been convicted of domestic violence or those who are prohibited from having guns because of a restraining order. We can raise awareness of the risks to abuse family members when firearms are present and ensure people can get the help they need. The domestic violence hotline, the national hotline, is available at 1-800-799-8233 and by text through their chat feature, which you can find at thehotline.org. They can help with local safety planning and local support services. Police and courts, even if operating with some limitations, as we know they are, in the current climate, may also be a resource, whether it's filing for an order electronically in some jurisdictions, using a Dropbox at the courthouse, or issuing orders at the scene by telephone. There are ways to get and provide help. We want to remind people also, those with firearms in their homes, please, to store those guns safely. Policymakers must ensure that these vulnerable at-risk families are considered as decisions are made about funding and essential services. A majority of Americans support limiting violent abusive partners' access to firearms. We want to make sure we have policies and procedures in place to protect the health and well-being of as many people as possible during this very difficult time, and that must include life-saving gun safety policies. So thank you. We'll take questions. And Peter, I'll turn it back over to you.
And Peter, you're online.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on mute. Sorry. Yep. Thank you very much, Julia. Very happy to introduce right now Rachel Graber, the Policy Director of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and somebody who has worked with us on these topics for now over 7 years. Rachel?
Hi, thanks, Peter, and thank you also, Senator Klobuchar, for your leadership on this issue, and Julie, for sharing all of your knowledge. Social distancing and staying in one's home, they're critical to slowing the spread of COVID-19, but for many people, home is not safe. Home, behind closed doors, away from friends and family, that's where the violence occurs. In normal times, domestic abusers seek to isolate survivors from their support systems in order to exert, maintain power control, as Julie said. And COVID-19 makes this easier. Increased isolation too often means escalating violence. And as Julie, again, also said, when an abuser has access to a firearm, this escalating violence can be deadly. The economic impact of COVID-19, it also hits survivors particularly hard. Many survivors are financially and housing unstable due to the economic abuse they experienced. And if they lose their jobs and can't pay their rent, they often have to choose between facing homelessness or returning to an abusive relationship. Right now, shelter access is limited, and many survivors are reluctant to enter shelters because they're worried that they or their kids might contract the virus. And what we've seen is that abusers are reinforcing these fears, saying if you go to the shelter, you will get COVID-19 because you will be in a confined space with a lot of other people. You could spread it, and they use that to exert power and control. COVID-19 has a lot of other impacts also that do affect survivors. Some courts have closed, making it harder for survivors to get protective orders. In some jurisdictions, we've heard that law enforcement officers are being instructed to limit contact and are only responding to violent misdemeanor crimes. So depending on the jurisdiction, that means that protective orders aren't being enforced, and child custody orders also are not being enforced. As always, survivors from historically marginalized communities, including immigrant survivors, they face additional barriers to accessing safety. And as has already been said, research shows that in times of crisis, the rate of intimate partner violence increases, so more people are experiencing intimate partner violence. TV programs are seeing an increase in requests for assistance at a time when due to social distancing requirements, their shelter capacity is decreasing. Volunteers are unable to perform their usual roles, and due to the economic crisis, donations are dwindling. As was mentioned by both the Senator and Julie, the Phase 3 stimulus package, it did provide some resources for domestic violence programs, which we really appreciate, but not nearly enough to meet the need. So amidst all of this, programs are doing their best to protect the health of their advocates and the survivors they serve. They're transitioning to remote advocacy whenever possible, and there are a lot of challenges related to that, related to the infrastructure, related to how to maintain confidentiality. So not all survivors have access to internet services or safe spaces where they can get remote services. Organizations such as us, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we're receiving a lot of calls and emails from shelters and community-based programs asking for help. And, of course, our capacity is being stretched as programs' capacity is also being stretched. Programs are seeking guidance on everything from, developing protocols for responding to shelter residents who may have been exposed to the virus, to working with judges to ensure survivors have access to protective orders, to safety planning in the time of COVID-19. Domestic violence programs, critical work continues. They are still open. They are doing the absolute best to support all of the survivors who reach out to them. But they are facing a lot of capacity issues. So their critical work continues, and they really are a rock in their communities in this time of crisis.
Great. Thank you very much, Rachel. And with that, we can answer a couple questions.
And if anyone has a question, you can press star then one on your touchtone phone. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. And I'm standing by for questions. And we do have a question from Lauren
Lomanchek.
Okay, there you go.
This question is from Senator Klobuchar. How are you, Senator?
Hey, what's your outlet, Lauren?
I'm from Care 11 in Minneapolis.
Well, thank you. All right. I'm glad you're directing it to me.
Yes, absolutely. We're glad to hear that your husband is feeling better, too. We have a story airing tonight on domestic violence in in shelters and access in Minnesota. Already some Minnesota police departments are seeing an uptick in calls, and Cornerstone here has seen an increase in calls to their helpline. If you could just talk a little bit more about that choice that so many domestic violence victims are facing between go out and potentially get sick or infect someone and staying home and potentially getting hurt, and what your advice is to them.
Well, I think that they should still call a hotline or a local domestic violence center and seek help, because we just can't have that be the choice. And we know how important it is for people to stay at home, but if they are fearful for their lives or their kids' lives, or they are already a victim of domestic abuse, they have to call, and we're going to have to figure something out for them, and the centers will. And I think one of the hardest things is people don't always go to centers. They find shelter other places. We know that with friends and family and moms and grandmas and grandpas. Mm-hmm. And especially with some of our seniors, that's a scarier thing to do right now, because you don't want to potentially give them the virus. And so I think that's why the shelters become more and more important, why we advocated for this increased funding, and why it's so important that you keep highlighting the story. I don't know if anyone wants to add to the Pardon?
Just to follow up on that funding, I missed the numbers. How much to domestic violence, and will some of that go directly to community-based shelters and hotlines?
Yes. So what was in the last bill, and we really want to build on it, which is what Senator Lisa Murkowski and I have been talking about, was $2 million for the National Domestic Hotline and $45 million for programs that provide shelter and other services. Obviously, that's not going to go out in one day, and so we need to get it out as soon as possible. There is already, unlike some of these emergency services, there's a flow of money that goes out to shelters anyway. So that will be important. And then in addition to that, I've led a letter with Senator Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska, asking the Department of Justice and the Health and Human Services directors about various questions, about what are the facts that they've seen nationally, how are they going to make sure that funding goes out, what have they done to give more flexibility to service providers who may be required to alter their programs. And I think some of this will be funds, but some of it will be work on the federal basis to work with the shelters on the ground. And maybe we can hear more in an answer to this from our experts that are on the call, because the answer is also, what are the shelters actually facing and what can we do to help?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did one of them want to answer this as well?
Julia, Rachel?
I'll
get in the queue.
Rachel, go ahead, Rachel. I can go. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we actually, in collaboration with many of our allied organizations in the domestic violence, sexual assault field, and intersecting fields, sent a letter out to House and to the Senate, you know, a sign-on letter with over 100 national organizations that signed on. And we do have some very specific asks. You know, the stimulus package that has absolutely nothing for sexual assault survivors. It doesn't address the needs of immigrant survivors. You know, so we're asking for $100 million for the sexual assault services program out of the Violence Against Women Act, another $55 million from the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act, and it's the one that was included in the past stimulus. We're asking for more money for Ottawa transitional housing, more money for the HUD Continuum of Care Domestic Violence Bonus Fund, and then we're also really focusing on making sure that culturally specific services, underserved populations, people with disabilities, and older adults also have access to funding to meet their particular needs. We're also looking for waiving match requirements for federal funds. You know, this was included for FIPSA in the stimulus package, but a lot of programs, they use volunteer hours to meet match requirements for grants. And what we're seeing right now is that you're just not having volunteers coming in because they are social distancing. They are abiding by best practices. And so programs are not going to be able to meet their match requirements. So those are some of the things that we're looking for.
And that's a great, yeah, and that's a great summary of things that we're going to be working toward. I'm sure there's going to be a fourth bill for funding and other things since we've seen an escalation of the virus and people already talking about things we would do because, remember, we had to immediately get funding out for the immediate problem. But this is clearly going to be a major priority of myself as well as Senator Murkowski and many others. And that's why we were in contact yesterday. And I thought that was a great summary of some of the things we're going to see that we need. And I think we want to get them all done, but that's a great list of priorities.
And our next question comes from Zach Cohen. Go ahead, Zach.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. Zach Cohen from National Journal. Senator Klobuchar, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about VAWA reauthorization. Are you still talking to folks like Senators Ernst and Feinstein about getting the House passed bill through the Senate, and do you see a path for that in the current context?
Well, I think that the context shows how necessary that bill is and that all of these, what I consider just political fights for no reason, when we know in the House it had over 20 Republican votes for it, and there's just no reason to stop this bill right now. It should be one that goes through unanimously, or, you know, if there's some Republicans that want to vote against it, you work out a procedure that's on a fast track to have them allow them to give their speeches and then pass it, because I think that and that's on Senator McConnell to do. I think they're just going to see, as we're already seeing this uptick, more and more of this. Or you could attach it somehow to the next legislative package. There's all kinds of things you can do. But this thing waited way too long, and now we're going to see more than ever why we need it in place. So are there discussions? Yes. We're just going to have to keep pushing over the next few weeks.
And our next question comes from Ann Givens. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi there. I've been reading and hearing on this call about the increase in domestic violence calls in recent days, sort of in correlation to the COVID crisis. I'm just wondering if there's any evidence one way or another about whether guns are a factor more or less often than they normally are in these calls, and also if there's any evidence or data at all on whether newly bought guns are a factor.
Maybe one of our experts can take it. And Ann, what organization are you with?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm with The Trace, which is a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to covering gun issues.
Thank you.
So this is Julia. This is Julia, and I would say that I don't have specific numbers for an increase in calls where firearms are mentioned or described within the last month, for example, in the pandemic, mm-hmm. but we know from the National Domestic Violence Hotline that they've seen over time, over the last couple of years, an increase in calls where firearms are an issue, where they've been used to threaten victims, there are firearms present in the homes. One of the challenges we also have is research suggests that there's a gender difference in knowledge about firearms in the home, that often women in the home have a lot less information about how many firearms there are in the home. So that's certainly a challenge. But the reality is that often the firearms are used just to threaten, let alone create a risk of injury and, unfortunately, too often, lethal outcomes.
So we know that there is that potential with the increased panic buying that we're hearing about, combined with the isolation and the increased calls to hotlines. And I don't know, Rachel, if you're hearing about specific increases with respect to firearms and calls to the hotlines and service providers.
I think what we would say is, first of all, we know that there are more calls, there is more outreach, but as far as sort of what the content of that is, and sort of looking at the data, that's not something that we really have at our hands right away. It's something that, you know, as we're going along, we collect, but we won't have any really good statistical data for you until we've had a little more time to see how things develop.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you all very much. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time for more questions. However, please email our press team at Giffords, and we will work to make sure we fully answer any question or inquiry you might have. I want to thank everybody on the call today, particularly Senator Klobuchar, for taking time out of your day. Our best wishes to the health of your family. You know, you've been a heroic senator and spouse as well. So thank you for all you do for us and for the you know, your constituents in Minnesota during this trying time. Thank you also, of course, to Julia and Rachel and everybody who called in from the press corps. And that concludes today's call. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.